listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hi, I'm Robin Whittaker, and this is the episode for Easter Week 2, where we're going to be discussing Acts 2, verse 14, and then verses 22 to 32, and the Gospel reading John 20, 19 to 31. If you're really keen on preaching on the 1 Peter series that begins this week, you might like to find our podcast series from the last lectionary cycle, so 3 years ago, where we really did a deep dive into those 1 Peter passages, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Sitting in as a guest co-host is my friend and colleague Greg Carey. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be with you.
Tell people who don't know you a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'm Professor of New Testament at Lancaster Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania in the United States, a seminary, the United Church of Christ, very much like the Uniting Church here in Australia.
Yeah, four denominations, you were telling me,
came together. Denominations came together. I really misspoke. We're learning five.
Ooh.
There was a Black American denomination that had always been included in one of the four, but that's not the history.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is brand new, so we're just learning.
We're learning.
Yeah.
But we're so ecumenical, so that's great. Yeah. And you preach, right, as a lay preacher?
I do preach. Yeah. I probably get to preach five or six times a year.
Yep.
Love it. And I've been preaching since I was 16 because I was Baptist.
Yeah, nice. Is that when they start you out in the Baptist church?
Yeah.
Probably, yeah. I think I preached my first sermon at 16 as well.
Really?
I dread to think what I said, but I'm pretty sure I used it to tell the church all the things I'd ever wanted to tell the church and probably needed to preach differently. But hey, that's another story. We're going to begin with the gospel reading. I suspect many of you will preach on this, and it's one of the great John 20 passages. We're picking up where one of the options for Easter last week was the John 20 first part of this chapter. And in the lectionary, we start now at verse 19 and go through to verse 31. The story, this is Easter evening where Jesus appears, and it's often called the story of Doubting Thomas, but I think that's unfair and we should avoid.
Stop picking on Thomas.
Stop picking on poor Thomas, who's just, being human and maybe not doubting so much. So, Greg, let's get into this. I have some big questions for you, and I do want to mention that Greg has just published a new book called Death, the End of History and Beyond. So this is eschatology in the Bible, and I know you've done some deep thinking about resurrection, and I have a couple of big questions for you, and one of them here with the Thomas story is how we think about bodies and resurrection and the fact that Jesus can magically walk through walls, but he's got these wounds. But perhaps before we get to that, let's just give some framing here. What's going on in this story? What do people need to know?
Well, one thing they need to know is that Jesus has already been seen by Mary.
Yes.
Right? So there's been this process of characters encountering evidence of the risen Jesus. Mm-hmm. Peter and the beloved disciple have run to the tomb, and Peter has seen, but the other disciple has believed.
Yes.
And Mary has seen Jesus, but doesn't believe until he calls her name.
Yes.
So now we have Jesus appearing to these presumably men who have heard that Mary has seen him.
Because the testimony in last week's lectionary passage is, I have seen the Lord.
Yeah.
This is the language of kind of belief at this point, right? It's all about seeing. So, yeah, we've got people and the context here of fear, right? So we're Passover in Jerusalem, big crowded city. We talked about this on the Palm Sunday episode, yeah. Possible political turmoil, people coming from all over the region. And we get this language of fear of the Jews, which I don't know how you feel about that, but...
Well, it's touchy language, yeah. Right? I mean, just remember that these Gospels are written before there's a religion called Christianity.
Yes.
And so we're not talking about Christians versus Jews.
Yeah. We're talking about these are all Jews at this point.
Yeah.
But they're fearing the other Jews. So I often prefer the translation. I know that there's huge debate amongst scholars about what we do with this, but one sort of way is to change the way we read this in Church of at least fear of the Jewish leaders or something like that to just qualify. And also remind people that Jesus and everyone else in the room is Jewish at this point. So,
and that's a big point of emphasis. And Jesus has just been crucified.
Yeah.
You know, this public execution marked as a rebel.
Yes, by the state.
Right.
Who's the real enemy in that sense.
So, of course, his disciples are scared.
Yeah. They're scared of being rounded up as one of his and maybe also crucified as an agitator and a rebel and a... Yep. So that's our context. And then Jesus... So let's get into what's going on with Jesus' resurrected body, because he just seems to appear from nowhere despite the doors being locked.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also interesting if you read the resurrection accounts in the Gospels, one after the other,
yep,
with that question of embodiment in mind.
Mm-hmm. Which you've done.
Which I've done. You know, it's Luke and John that emphasize Jesus being embodied. Mm. And yet there's, when I talk about resurrection, I like to talk about continuity.
Yep.
So there's continuity. This is Jesus. He's recognizable.
Yep.
He has wounds. Yep. That presumably you could touch.
Yeah, because Thomas will, well, ask or be invited to touch.
Right. It's not clear that Thomas touches, but it's there.
Yeah, yeah.
And the body is there, and yet the body is discontinuous.
Yeah.
Right? Because Jesus can show up in a locked room.
Yeah. What do we do with that? I mean, do you see Jesus' body or the descriptions of Jesus' body in the Gospels? You know, and let me reframe this. So, you know, as Christians, I think we talk about Jesus' resurrection. You know, it's this first fruits language. Like, this is the resurrection believers are promised as well.
Yes.
And maybe in some traditions, all.
Yes.
So what does that suggest to us about our own bodies? I know there's people who've worked on this, both now and in the future. How do we think about these things?
Well, I think... In fact, in preparing to visit Australia, I read up on reports of Australian religion.
Oh.
Most Australians expect a life beyond death.
That's interesting.
Most Americans do.
Yes. That doesn't surprise me, that part.
Yeah. It's a little, well, yeah, you're less convinced than Americans are.
Yeah.
But I think the most common notion, just going to funerals, having friends, mm-hmm, is... You die and you have a spirit that wanders off somewhere.
Yeah.
And the body is left behind. And early Christians talked about the resurrection of the body.
Yeah.
The creed says the resurrection of the body. So I think there's an emphasis on God's reclamation of the whole self.
Yeah.
And an affirmation that bodies matter.
Yeah. Our physicality or however we're, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what we do with our bodies matters and. All, a whole lot of implications that
how we relate to other bodies.
Yes.
So, you know, we can go back in our lives and think about the ways that we have mistreated our own bodies and mistreated the bodies of others.
Mm.
And to imagine that the idea of resurrection is radical in that it is reclaiming the whole of that and giving it life.
Yeah. And I do love that there's both continuity and discontinuity.
Yeah.
I suspect, you know, depending on your own experience of your own body, what you wish to be continuous and not, you know, might differ, but that there is something recognizable. I know in this later text, like the, I think it's the Apocalypse of Peter off the top of my head, where one of the punishments for the sinners is that they can't recognize their loved ones. Yeah, in the afterlife.
I'd forgotten that, yeah. Yeah.
So there's something about being able to recognize the people important to us that I think is part of the embodiedness that's about human connection.
There is. And you also talked about our different relationships to our bodies.
Mm.
So I'm 57. I'm frustrated with it more often than I used to be.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe you know our colleagues Candida Moss and Megan Henning have written about disabled bodies.
Yep. And in the afterlife and
the resurrection. Yeah. And does, you know, and they want to emphasize, I think, that God reclaims us as we are and as we have been.
Yeah, exactly. Which in their work, they're particularly looking at disability and the way we in the Christian church often talk really unhelpfully about disability and make all sorts of assumptions about what healing looks like. And they're talking about this affirming bodies that are different.
Absolutely.
And differently abled, yeah. So early Christians, and we see this certainly in like the 1 Corinthians 15 passage is famous, that there's something about Christianity and this embodiment that was probably quite countercultural, right? I mean, the prevailing religions had this Greek notion of the soul ascending, and which is still everywhere in the church, I have to say.
Oh.
Yeah. Anything else we should think about with bodies and touch and...
Well, I will say, and I'll admit that this a little bit is my own nutty theory.
Okay, good.
But I've seen other people express it, that when Christians have lost sight of valuing bodies, we have tended to do harm or to neglect poverty, disease. You know, there are streams of Christianity that go into an entirely spiritual mode.
Yes.
And so the idea of resurrection reminds us that bodies matter right now.
Yeah. So it gives us an ethical mandate almost.
I mean, yeah.
That might be odd language for something like this, but yeah.
All of who we are, God brings back and pulls together.
Yes, that's beautiful. So what else do we need to notice about this story? So if we come back to what Thomas is doing in this story, and we both flagged earlier that maybe calling him doubting Thomas is unfair, he is not with them for this initial appearance. And now we have, so we've had Mary say, "I've seen the Lord." Now we have the disciples say in verse 25, "We have seen the Lord." And Thomas says, unless I see, and then unless I put my fingers in his side. So see and touch, very sensory stuff going on here. And then, of course, we get the story where Jesus will appear and invite him to touch. What do you think we should draw out of that as preachers? Is there a...
Well, I don't think it's helpful to think other disciples good, Thomas bad.
Yes.
Right? But it's not just a matter of like my pastoral opinion. The passage goes there. Jesus, when Thomas does recognize Jesus, my Lord and my God.
Yes.
Jesus says, "Have you believed because you've seen? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet come to believe." And then we get those concluding verses in chapter 20, you know, for people who haven't seen, these things have been written so that you can believe.
Yeah.
I would encourage everyone who preaches this passage to go through chapter 20 and even into the first seven or so verses of chapter 21 and make a chart. Mm-hmm. Who sees what and when do they believe? Because in my experience, one of the most limiting factors in the lives of Christian believers is the sense that they don't believe right, or they don't believe enough, or they don't believe adequately. And what you notice in John's resurrection stories, all these characters see and experience things related to Jesus' resurrection, but their responses are different at different times. Yeah. And the best thing you can do, I think, is just sit down and read it and make a chart, because our response, there's no single right response to Jesus in these stories.
No, and I really like that. And again, it's a way of maybe even imagining ourselves into the stories and reflecting on our own experiences, if we've had spiritual experiences or the ways we've encountered Jesus, which can include all sorts of ways of including, you know, some, you know, spiritual experience that might involve sight or hearing or something, but also other less tangible ways of sensing God that are about, what prompts our belief, I think, and what do we rely on? And, I like that there's partiality. I mean, the beloved disciple sees an empty tomb. That's what he gets.
Yeah.
Right? Mary sees someone she doesn't initially recognize until he calls her name, so there's something in the connection of the naming and the voice that she recognizes.
Right.
Thomas needs to touch wounds. You could play with that kind of, we all get these different experiences and different ways that we come into faith.
I think that would be comforting to a lot of people.
Yeah. Along with, I love what you said before. I think, you know, this is probably the, out of all the resurrection stories we're going to get in this kind of Easter season, the one that perhaps most lends itself to some careful reflection on what it means to be embodied both now and in
absolutely.
The afterlife. Yeah,
absolutely.
And you can go order Greg's book and read about that.
I did try it.
Yeah, that's right. Perhaps it's time to move on to the Acts passage.
Yeah.
Did you know you could join our Facebook group, By the Well, for extra content and discussion?
So Acts 2, and we have verse 14, which really is just there to give us a bit of context that this is a speech of Peter addressing the men of Judea and all who live in Jerusalem. So again, in Jerusalem, big crowd, just after still Passover season, right? We're still in that week.
It's Pentecost now.
Yeah, yeah. And then we get a chunk of the speech that starts at verse 22 and goes for about 10 verses, where again we're going to get this, a kind of Peter's summary of the gospel.
Yeah.
You know, that God sent this man, he did these signs, he was crucified, he was killed, but God raised him up, verse 24, freed him from death, lovely way to think about death, being freed from death. And then he'll go on to talk about, again, being raised up in verse 32 and being exalted, which is a typical Lucan thing, that the resurrection and the exalting of Jesus are ultimately the signs that this is God's chosen, innocent, and vindicated Messiah, yeah. I think. Some different themes here, I mean, but not least, I think, well, maybe I should ask you first before we get to the resurrection stuff specifically. Are there other things you notice in the passage, Greg, that I think we might want to focus on? Or
yeah, you could look at all the big speeches in Acts, and especially if they have a Jewish audience, the story is going to be the same.
Yes.
You know, God started with Israel, worked through the prophets. Prophets didn't do well. Jesus, he was rejected too. But
exactly.
Yeah, God raised him from the dead and highly exalted him.
Yeah, and the quoting, and some of these speeches can be long and, dare I say, even a little bit tedious to read at times. We get quotes of scripture, but yeah, he's addressing a Jewish audience, he's telling a narrative and making these connections. And I do love the comparison with David we get towards the end. You know, fellow Israelites, I say to you, you know, David died, was buried, his tomb is with us. The difference with Jesus, his tomb is empty. This is the core message of the preaching, right? The resurrection.
Yeah.
So I think my question to you, Greg, as someone who's thought deeply about this in writing a book about eschatology, which is very brave, why do you think for early Christians the resurrection became so central? I mean, it is, particularly in Luke Acts, I think all these speeches, it's about, yes, there's death, but there's resurrection.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah. And maybe it's helpful to sort of set that resurrection is still kind of a new idea in Judaism as the New Testament's being written.
Yeah.
So part of the answer, I think there are two basic parts of the answer. If you have a Messiah, you know, in chapter one, his disciples say, we thought this was the time you would redeem Israel. Are you ready? And yet he gets killed. Encountering him alive, a resurrection, is a verdict on who he really is.
Yes.
So just that by itself. But if you set it in the context of resurrection expectation in the ancient world, we don't have any Jewish text from the period that imagined one person being raised from the dead alone.
No, you're right. Yeah.
So
we have visions of mass resurrection, right? In some kind of way.
Right. And it is at the end times.
Yes.
When the resurrection happens.
Yeah.
So the idea that, you know, Paul calls it the first fruits. Jesus is the first fruits from among the dead in 1 Corinthians 15. This is what Peter is saying. Now Jesus is risen. And this is why you're encountering the Holy Spirit, because the resurrection of Jesus brings the Spirit out.
Yeah. And we're in this, kind of new era, right? The world has changed in some way because of this.
This is the beginning of the fulfillment of everything.
Yeah. And I mean, Paul will put it differently, but again, around, you know, death and sin have been defeated. These things do not need to have complete dominion over your life because of what's happened in Jesus. Let's just go back to what you said there. I think it is really helpful to remember that resurrection was not a common kind of something people were expecting. Can you tell us a little bit more about when ideas of resurrection emerged? Because there's almost, depending who you read, no reference to it, or maybe one or two references to resurrection in the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament. But by the time we get to the New Testament, it seems like there's still some dispute, but it's a bit more of a plausible idea.
Right. So the only text, in my opinion, in our Old Testament, Hebrew Bible, depending on which language you use, is Daniel 12.
Yeah, I agree.
But there are, I think, other passages that as ancient Jews began thinking about resurrection, filtered into that imagination. You know, the Valley of the Dry Bones in Ezekiel 37.
Yeah, that get reformed and,
yeah. But what we begin to see around that second century before the time of Jesus, as apocalyptic literature is emerging, is more and more resurrection conversation among Jews. And you noted, it's still controversial. Even in the Gospels, right, the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection.
They try, and one of their questions to Jesus is about the absurdity of the resurrection and who will be married to who and all of this kind of stuff. They try and kind of catch him out.
Yeah, and it's not like they don't know their Judaism.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's Anathea Portia Young who I probably first read this in, but this idea of resurrection emerging in those apocalyptic texts, particularly in a time of kind of oppression and a shifting theology about this vindication. So Jesus again becomes this symbol of, I guess, God's no to human violence, death, evil forces that oppress. I don't know what you think of that.
Yeah, so Daniel, you know, we mentioned the only clear reference to resurrection is in Daniel, is written in response to a Jewish revolt.
Yeah.
Against oppression, and Jesus is executed by Romans.
Yeah, exactly. So, again, the political context, I think, helps. It doesn't explain the theology, but it helps give a context to where this theology is or how this theology is emerging.
God has made him, Peter says, Lord and Messiah.
Yeah, that's political language, right?
It absolutely is.
Yeah, Lord and King, really. Yeah. So, preaching. Let's think about preaching in the season of Easter. It's the season where we kind of celebrate in all sorts of ways the resurrection. What kind of things might you preach this week?
I gave my hint when I talked about the relationship between seeing and believing in John. I've had so many pastors tell me it's hard to preach Easter year after year.
Yeah.
But if you pay close attention to each individual text, it's not... It is affirming that Jesus has been raised, but it's also doing it in a particular way that's relevant in its context.
Yeah, I agree. And I think getting into the specific dynamics of each text, and I mean, maybe if you've preached John a whole stack, there's something new to be uncovered in this, teasing out some things in this Acts passage as well, or thinking about, you know, what it might mean in your context. What's the good news of resurrection? I mean, I think that's the challenge, right? That's the ultimate challenge. What's the good news of resurrection? How does that actually transform the way we live now to live as people who anticipate?
It's more than just we have a way of escaping death, which is no small thing.
No, it's right? No small thing.
But it is a way of saying that God is taking our whole lives and the whole world and bringing them to fullness. Reclaiming them. That's what resurrection is.
Well, thank you, Greg Carey, for being with us these last few weeks on the podcast. We really appreciate it. And I do recommend if people want to, Easter is a perfect time to dig into Greg's book, Death, The End of History and Beyond, in that interpretation series. So thanks, Greg.
Thank you, Robin.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.